Bite into a stacked sandwich made with Hero Bread. And the only thing you'll think is, delicious. You won't think it has up to 19 grams protein, 11 to 32 grams of fiber, or just 0 to 5 grams net carbs. But it does. Hero Bread. No compromises, just loaves, buns, tortillas, bagels, and noodles packed with flavor. Right now, get 10% off at hero.co with code IHEART. That's hero.co, code IHEART. All figures per serving of Hero Bread. See nutrition facts on hero.co.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Bob spent, 3 weeks?
Yep.
At the trial, was actually out there at the trial, so he was in the courtroom, saw the entire defense case in chief. So Bob's joining me today. We're going to kind of break this down. We're going to start off, just for those of you that aren't familiar with the Lindsey Clancy case, we are going to just kind of go through like the basics of the fact, what the case is that we're talking about. Then we'll move into some of the legal theory stuff, and then from there we'll go on to some of Bob's experiences from at the trial. And we both tend to be yappers. I'll try to get all that done in under an hour. Bob, thanks for joining me.
Always, Bob. Always love to hang, man. Always love to hang.
So first and foremost, the case itself. This is interesting. You know, I famously am a true crime podcaster that doesn't know anything about true crime. So this is one of these things that snuck up on me. Like, this is how I know something interesting or important is going on, because people start asking me about it. So
yeah,
when this trial began, a bunch of people were asking me about the Lindsey Clancy case. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then as it got to be more and more, I started digging into it a little bit, learned a little bit about the case, and then came all the legal theory stuff that just blew my mind. So for anybody like me that maybe didn't know or doesn't know, you know, what the actual case is, what happened, so kind of break that down for us. What was the case that we were dealing with in this trial?
So back in 2023, January 24th of 2023, you had a woman named Lindsey Clancy, who was a mother, married to a man named Patrick Clancy. They had three beautiful little children, Cora, who was their oldest, she was 5, Dawson, who was 3, and then their baby, Callan, who was only 8 months old. On January 24th, in their family home in Duxbury, Massachusetts, Lindsey strangled her 3 children, all 3 of them, with exercise bands, before herself jumping out of a second-story window, falling to the earth, shattering her spine, and she's now a paraplegic. She had also tried to cut her own throat and also her wrists. There was a lot of debate, which we'll get into in trial, whether or not the Commonwealth is trying to put that as kind of a ruse initially. By the end of the trial, they end up, pursuant to their own experts, saying that it was a serious suicide attempt. They had changed their tune by closing. So that was a strange act. It's kind of a strange account of what they thought was going on in terms of their theory. But ultimately, she is taken to the hospital. She's arrested at that point. And, you know, from there, the case is charged. Callan, the baby, was still alive for a period of time. So originally, she wasn't charged with his murder. But as soon as he passed, they charged her with all 3, you know, first degree murder on all 3 counts. So it's a devastating case, man. It's like, and you look at it, its face like that. And then, so she's arrested right away, and she hires Patrick Reddington as her attorney right away. The family did. I think they were able to retain him, and he's kind of a longtime legendary lawyer, criminal defense guy down there. And he took the case on, and he's been working it for 3+ years. All the way through trial. And ultimately, you know, the state proceeded on this. And it's interesting, because ultimately this case becomes a not guilty for lack of criminal responsibility case, which is the equivalent to not guilty by reason of insanity. So they call it a different thing in Massachusetts. And another interesting thing about it in Mass is the fact that there the burden is on the Commonwealth to prove that she wasn't psychotic, which is a tough thing because you're having to prove a negative, which is always very, very hard to do.
Right.
So in most jurisdictions, frankly, the burden is on the defense to prove that their client is insane. And legally insane and medically insane are two completely different things. But we'll get into that when we start talking about kind of the logistics of the defense in the case.
And more, so kind of more details of the crime itself. So this, the basis of all of this, the way I understand it, is Lindsay was suffering from postpartum depression. Kind of what was up for debate at trial, I think, was that there's a term which I'd never heard of, postpartum psychosis. From what I had heard, and you correct me if I'm wrong about this, that she had been kind of crying out for help, where she had been like talking to her husband, and I don't know if it's friends or doctors, but saying that, you know, she's having all these like iterations where she's having feelings of wanting to hurt the children. She was like, she was struggling for a while. The husband, Patrick, he was, because this is what immediately when it came out, the internet decided the husband did it. And this was all some big crazy conspiracy. From the little bit of research I've done, like, that's not even a quite, like, he's on surveillance cameras at the CVS. Like, he had left her home with the kids, went to the store, went to CVS or some pharmacy or something.
Yeah, CVS first, and then this place called 3B. So, yeah, if you want me to get into that kind of it, like, that's really the trial stuff when they kind of put their theory out. So, yeah, with her second child, Dawson, she had first experienced some level of postpartum depression, all right? And in that particular, during that pregnancy and more after it, when she slips into the postpartum, there was evidence that came in at trial that it appears that she had some kind of manic episode after she had Dawson. Like, she had run like a 5K, like 4 days after giving birth. She was like manically cleaning the house, just like doing a lot of things that were kind of like a little bit strange for a woman that had just given birth to a baby. And so you fast forward to, but she comes out of the depression, and then they have the third child. And when Callan's born, this thing kind of develops later. And again, like, it depends on when you want to talk about this shit, because it really is the kind of the crux of the whole defense. That's why I didn't jump into that.
I guess let's try to focus on, because I kind of got out there with it, with the, you know, what they're trying to prove at trial.
Yeah, I was just giving you the underlying facts.
But as far as like what we know happened, like, we know that at least prior to the murders, she was claiming to, or she was saying she was struggling. We can say that. Yeah.
There's no question she was struggling.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, that was not an issue. At the end of the trial, every expert agreed that she had a mental disease or defect. Now, some were calling it bipolar too. Obviously, the defense experts, including Resnick, was saying she was psychotic. So,
right,
you know, that's where it kind of landed.
So we know that because I think it's oversimplifying to be like she just killed her kids. Like, there was something going on. She kills the kids. She attempts suicide unsuccessfully, which would result in her being a paraplegic. Now, at some point, like, did she right away? I know the husband came home, Patrick came home, and finds all this happened in the house when he gets home. Did she was she conscious? Did she right away tell him? What did she confess? Was there ever any question that she was the one that did this?
No. And again, that's an interesting thing. And as you were talking about, like, the whole TikTok conspiracy thing that Patrick did it, that kind of exploded. And I remember when it happened, some EMT came on and was like, oh, you know, if her thyroid was crushed and her spine was crushed, there's no way she'd be able to make words. And interestingly, not during the defense's case in chief, but when they had the Commonwealth's rebuttal case on, and they had one of their experts on, I think it was their second expert, this doctor named Kirk Heilbrunn. He was testifying, and under cross, Reddington, who was Lindsay's attorney, asked a question: have you ever listened to the 911 call? Did you ever hear the 911 call? And he's like, no, because there's a portion in time, because of the way that it really went down is so Patrick had been sent out, and this is like under the Commonwealth's theory, that Lindsay around 4 o'clock in the afternoon starts planning for Patrick to be out of the house so that she can commit this horrible atrocity against her children. And at that point, she had brought, I think it was Cora to the doctor. I'm not 100% on that. All the facts are starting, like, that part of it is getting a little fuzzy. But one of the kids she brought to the doctor, and she was having stomach issues. And they're like, the doctor's like, you need to get Miralax. Miralax. They had been out of it at the Walgreens, I think. And then she ends up calling the CVS to make sure they had Miralax. I think they said, we don't have the Miralax, but we have our version of it. Mm-hmm. So she then had decided during that day that she wasn't in the mood. She wasn't up for cooking, and that dinner had gotten there, and she wasn't. She's like, let's just order from this 3V place. And, you know, you go pick it up. And it's like, she had Googled the distance. You know, so these are the things that the Commonwealth is looking at when they're looking at the case file and their reports from the cops. They're like, wow, she was really planning this thing out. Like, she was trying to get rid of him long enough in order for her to be able to do all the things that she was planning on doing. And then ultimately, the place was like 9-10 minutes away from the house. Like, so it wasn't like some great distance. And it turns out that the place that they normally ordered from, at least I've had multiple people tell me that their typical go-to for takeout was closed on Tuesdays. Mm-hmm. So that's why she went to this, had him go to the 3V. And ultimately, so he's at the pharmacy, and at some point he calls her. Okay. Like, that, the call to Lindsay is like one of the big sticking points for the Commonwealth in this case. There's a call that takes place and she doesn't answer, but then she calls him back. And it's like a 14-second conversation, and we don't know what was said, really. You know, I mean, we have Patrick's account for the most part. She doesn't recall what the conversation was. But in their estimation, you know, the way that they theorize the case, the way that they tell the story, it's like she's in the middle of doing this to her children. She stops to make this call. Patrick said she sounded normal. Mm-hmm. Makes the call, and then the call hangs up, and then she goes back to doing it. That's kind of what the Commonwealth's theory is. In terms of the timeline, I mean, I don't know how the state is proving their timeline as to when things happen. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's, again, one of the things about the case that is weird is that the investigation by law enforcement was not good at all. They just didn't investigate it properly. They missed like an entire drawer full of pill bottles, you know, like on like inexplicably. Like, I don't know how they missed it. There were five cops in that bedroom. It was in the bedroom nightstand. They somehow didn't find it. Reddington and his PI, when they go into the house after the scene was cleared, they find this drawer full of pills, and he calls the DA. He's like, well, I found this evidence. Do you want it? You know, it's like, your guys missed this shit. So the whole investigation was awful, which has really kind of led to, you know, the wild speculation about Patrick being the one who did this, because it just was basically Patrick's account of what had happened. So to go back to your original question as to whether or not, when he comes upon, so he gets home, okay, goes into the house. The house is usually loud with three kids, as it would be.
Yeah.
And it's dead quiet. So he's like, hello, hello. Goes, you know, upstairs. His bedroom door is locked. He's like, that's weird. Unlocks the door, walks in, sees the windows open, sees blood on the floor, looks out the window, sees Lindsay laying on the ground down there, runs back out of the house, goes to the yard. And this is in January, right? So it's like frozen ground, snow. Mm-hmm. And this is when the 911 call is made. All right. At least this portion of it. Like, so, because you can hear her. So Red asks this expert Heilbrunn on the stand. I know I'm jumping around a little bit, but try to stick with me, because I'm trying to fit these things in. This is when he asks Heilbrunn, you know, did you hear the 911 call? He's like, no. And he's like, well, would it surprise you that the only noises that Lindsay could make were grunting? She couldn't make a full sentence. She couldn't speak. And so there was a reporter there named Sue O'Connell. I was not there when they played the 911 call, because I didn't go for the homicide portion. I just wanted to go for the lack of criminal responsibility portion of the case. So I get out there the day that they're cross-examining Dr. Tufts, the first doctor that they put on. So at any rate, he's like, no, I didn't listen to it. And he's like, so you're not aware that that Lindsay could not make words, that there's no way that she was saying full sentences, like they're in the basement or I tried to kill myself. Like she couldn't have said any of those things. She couldn't speak. And that's like another thing that like put the Patrick Guilters on high alert. They're like, he couldn't say anything. Like they're just going on, you know.
So Patrick said, tells police that she told him what she did.
Yeah. He said he testified at trial that she had said to him that I tried to kill myself. He's like, where are the kids? And she says the basement. So then he goes down. He's still on the 911 call. And this is that part of the 911 call that everybody who was in the courtroom was like just incredibly upsetting, like PTSD type shit hearing, because you can hear in this man's voice when he discovers his three kids have been killed. He's like screaming, you know, like there's no way that like anybody who heard it is like, there's no way anybody that heard that thinks that that was some like him acting.
Yeah.
Like it was too real. So he's screaming, you know, that she killed the kids. And so at that point, you know, law enforcement gets over there. He takes the bands off of the kids' necks. And, you know, he testifies, and this becomes an issue at trial, kind of a heated issue as to whether or not the bands were knotted. And when I say knotted, he kind of explained it or described it as like how we would tie our shoes, where you know, lace the lace over first before you put the loops in. So you've got that first initial thing. And these are rubber bands, you know, exercise bands. So, and he's like, I was struggling to get them undone. So they were, you know, so that whole part of it was in heavy dispute at trial, because the state was trying to make it sound like that she was manually having to do this the entire time, when in fact, you know, once she got it tightened around their necks, it just remained tight. And they were all killed in different areas of the basement. I think one of the children was killed in Patrick's office, and then another one in the exercise room, and one in the living room, kind of the finished basement. And, you know, it's like from that moment forward, they get out there, they get her to the hospital. She's arrested, you know, and she's handcuffed to the bed. They can't get anybody in to see her. And so, you know, and Patrick's obviously just stunned. You know, I mean, like, I can't even imagine what that would be like walking into that, you know. And it's like, what do you think, Bob, if you walked into that scene coming back from even knowing that your wife's struggling for 4 months, even knowing that she's having intrusive thoughts, and she's, because her treatment or whatever you want to call she received for the 4 months from really September all the way up until January, and we're coming out of COVID. This is 2022, December, you know, from September of 2022 leading up to January of 2023. We're coming out of the COVID. It's starting to loosen up, like the lockdown is ending. We're using Zoom for lawyers. Doctors are using telemedicine. You know, I mean, the world had changed.
Yeah.
So she first starts treating with a psychiatrist named Jennifer Tufts. And they're all 14 of her appointments with her are telemedicine. So she never sees her, like physically, never comes into her office. And it's a psychiatrist. And Lindsay's going through it. Like she was having like terrible anxiety. She was having an incredible, difficult time sleeping. She was depressed as shit. And, you know, so she's explaining all this. And in the meantime, the background is that Lindsay was a labor and delivery nurse. And she had been. And she loved kids. And I mean, that was her life's work. She was delivering babies. They named their first baby after the first child that she helped deliver, which was Cora. So like that's how much it meant to her. And so, you know, 3 years goes by. Reddington gives notice in 2024 around January that he's going to be going with the not guilty for lack of criminal responsibility, which is, again, essentially just an insanity defense. And at that point, like the narrative of the case shifts, and really it becomes the defense focuses on this is an issue with the mental health care that she received, with the healthcare system in particular, and in particular is postpartum depression and postpartum psychosis, which in his estimation and mine as well is grossly ignored. And it is a situation wherein women are afraid. But let's get into that as we keep going, because that's a whole different thing. That's really, to me, the Commonwealth is trying to push it away from that and say that this case isn't about that. The defense is going to try to make it about that, but we're not going to allow it. It's about the kids. It's about whether or not she was responsible. But you can't separate the two. They're too close. They're intertwined.
Right. Well, I wonder, you know, you mentioned earlier that there was a poor investigation. I wonder if part of the right, because I've just seen this in so many cases where the case seems very obvious.
Right.
So the cops don't put a whole lot of effort. You know, if they come home, three dead kids, she's jumped out the window. She said she did it. You know, they're probably not worried too much about trying to prove who did it, because it's not like some stranger came in. I wonder if that played into the
100%
lack of investigation.
100%. But I mean, the lesson to be learned is you can't do that.
Right. Yeah.
You still got to do the work, you know, because at the end of the day, essentially, the entire case is built on Patrick's narrative.
Right.
You know, that like that's the problem. That's what allows the people out there that are going after this poor guy that lost everything, including his three kids, his marriage, his life, everything in the blink of an eye, are torturing him, you know, and they're going after this guy. Had they done a proper investigation, because it was really based on just what he said happened.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, without anything else, without them really doing the investigation into the house. So, you know, had that been done, and again, it's that thing where, you know, it's one of those frustrating cases. Like, had you done a proper investigation, we're not here. You know, like in terms of that bullshit going on with Patrick, you know,
many cases. I say that all the time about when we're sitting there talking about the Anand Syed case or the West Memphis 3 case or the Delphi case, all these big
Karen
cases.
Karen Reed.
They were still talking about over and over and over again. It's like the only reason we're having these conversations is because it was a piss poor investigation.
Right.
There's all these holes you can see. Like, had you done this, we would have the answer to this. We can't get the answer to this now, but you could have back then.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
What I want to focus on now before we get into the trial stuff is just really, because this is the question that comes to me. I've had people at school or I teach asking me, my wife, my kids, everybody, and I don't know the fucking answer to it. You know, Becky was just asking me the day the mistrial was declared, Friday or whenever it was.
Yeah.
She was like, well, so what, like, if they voted not criminally responsible, what does that mean? Is she still guilty? Does she doesn't go to prison? Does she go to a mental institution? Does she go to the mental institution for the rest of her life? Or is it, so what, you know, the defense was, and to be clear, and there's a memes about this all over the internet, but I think it's worth pointing out.
Right.
Lindsay said Lindsay did it. Patrick said Lindsay did it. Lindsay's attorney said Lindsay did it. The prosecutor said Lindsay. There's no question that Lindsay did this.
Right.
That's not a question here.
Right.
But the defense is, yes, she did it, but she shouldn't be held criminally responsible. What does that mean?
So essentially what that means, so that there's, in Massachusetts, they use the McCool standard, which comes from a case, and it's M-C-H-O-U-L, okay. Right? And so it's kind of a hybrid, and it's different. So what they have to initially establish, so there's got to be a prima facie showing by the defense that she had a mental illness or defect, okay? And then once that happens, the burden is shifted completely over to the prosecution, and they have to prove that two things. So once they get over the, was there a mental disease or defect hump, it then becomes a two-pronged test, and it's an and-or proposition, not an and. So it's actually an or. It could be both, but it doesn't have to be both. So the first thing that they have to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that she did not know right from wrong, putting it simply. Like okay. that she didn't understand that she was, you know, she wasn't capable of obeying the law because of her mental disease or defect.
Right.
Or they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she didn't have psychosis, which would have rendered her incapable of conforming her conduct to the requirements of the law, meaning that something was going on to where she couldn't stop herself from doing what she was doing because something else was controlling her mind. That was the psychosis portion of it. So, you know, and they don't have to prove both. They just have to prove
one or the other.
And so ultimately, if she were found not guilty, so she's not guilty, but she is institutionalized. So she goes directly into a state hospital and then she remains there. It could be indefinitely, could be for the rest of her life. And she will be evaluated annually. So they will come in front of a judge. The judge will get updated. All right, well, where is she at? Is she a danger to herself or others? And, you know, is she still mentally ill? You know, so if she's still mentally ill and a danger to herself or others, she stays in. And so annually they would do that in perpetuity. If there comes a day where she's found to be healed or better or well, and obviously they're going to look at the fact that she's in a wheelchair forever in terms of the dangerousness level, you know, theoretically she'd be released, but no. So, and the jury was made aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
So like typically in your normal trials, short of a death penalty trial, where obviously a jury is made aware of the fact that it's going to be a death penalty case because you get into that heavily in voir dire as to whether or not people have a moral issue with the death penalty, and would they not be capable if it was required of them to say, yes, we want to sentence them to the death penalty or the defendant to the death penalty, that they wouldn't be able to do it because of their own conscience and their own morality. And then they wouldn't be able to get on the jury. So here, you know, they are told in the jury instruction that she's just not getting, you know, she's not wheeling out of the courtroom and she's not a free woman. She gets institutionalized. So that's in part of the jury instruction.
Now, real quick, I just want to make clear, yeah. There was no option for the jury. The defense, my understanding is like the defense basically conceded this. There was no option for the jury where she's not guilty and she walks free. They weren't
there
even
there was
trying.
An option.
There yeah, was there an was, option for
there
that.
There was a not guilty option, yeah.
So there's not so guilty or not guilty due to lack of criminal.
Correct.
Okay.
And they added manslaughter late, like after, like, and that was at the request of Reddington, which was interesting because it really doesn't work with the fact pattern. Like legally, you can't get to manslaughter in terms of kind of making the elements fit. And it's because of the fact that you have this situation where by operation of law, if you're coming in with a insanity defense or a lack of criminal responsibility, you're admitting that your client did the acts.
Right.
You're saying, yes, I did the acts, but you can't hold me criminally responsible because I had a mental disease or defect and it didn't allow me to conform my conduct to the requirements of the law, or I didn't understand right from wrong. I was out of my fucking mind.
Yeah.
It wasn't me. Like I couldn't think. There was no way for me to differentiate between this weird reality that I was in and what actual reality was. I was gone. So that thing right there makes it impossible because they had to prove both elements. They had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the homicides. So they had to prove that up.
That's
meaning
what happened.
They had to put that
at the
case
beginning.
Up. Right. That's the beginning of the case. And the way that it had worked is Reddington's like, well, you know, we'll stipulate to all that, meaning that by agreements of the parties, that's not at issue. We'll just put it in. We'll read it to the jury. We can avoid all this part of the trial. And the Commonwealth's like, no. Or, you know, you're trying to gloss over the fact that these three little beautiful children were lost. We need to be able to get into that with the jury so they have an understanding of why we're here. And we're not willing to do that. So we're going to put our case on like we have a right to do. And so there was nothing the judge could do about it. They declined the stipulation. They put that portion of the case on. And before that had happened, pre-trial, Reddington had asked to bifurcate the cases. He wanted them separated into two separate trials. He wanted the homicide trial as one separate trial, and then the lack of criminal responsibility as a separate trial. Because of this issue with like the investigation. He's like, I really can't attack the investigation at all, like with a Bowdoin defense, which is a Massachusetts thing, which is saying, look, because of the awful investigation here, you can't trust it. Therefore, you can't trust the case in terms of the evidence that they presented to you because it was a terrible investigation. He's like, because of this fact that I brought forth the lack of criminal responsibility defense, I'm completely hamstrung. I can't attack the investigation because we've admitted that she did it.
Yeah.
So it's like you've got this weird thing happening where there was an awful investigation, but he really can't attack it because, again, he's going forward with this lack of criminal responsibility thing, which is admitting that he did it. So what difference does it make? And, you know, if you're looking at it from 1,000 feet back, you know, you're like, well, who cares about the investigation? It's like, we know what happened here. She killed the kids. We're just trying to figure out the other thing. And it's not that simple. So that manslaughter thing that they brought in really doesn't legally fit.
Right.
So it's a confusing thing.
Even the fact that there was an option to fully acquit doesn't make sense to me, because to me, that's the jury voting that the Commonwealth didn't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she actually killed the kids, right? That's the only way you can fully acquit her.
Right.
When the entire time the defense is acknowledging that she killed the kids. Like, I don't know how that could even be an option.
You know, it's that weird thing, Bob, where we have to wonder, because this jury wasn't sequestered, all right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're given the three questions every day that they come in. You're not watching anything on the social media. You're not watching the news. You're not reading the newspaper. You're not talking to your friends or neighbors or your family about it. But are they really?
Yeah, of course they are.
I mean, how do you avoid it?
You couldn't get away from
market.
It.
Dude, in that town? Fucking, like, there's no way.
Well, on their phones. You're down in that. You couldn't open any social media app and have it not be all over the place.
Geofencing, it knows where you're at. It's going to always give you shit that's going on in your area because of geofencing. And then, but I'm talking about, all right, say they're able to stay somehow. They're able to stay off their phone, which is impossible. No one's doing that.
Right.
We're all too tethered to the thing. If they go to the market, and they're standing in line, and the two people behind them are talking about the Clancy case. Oh, did you hear about have you heard about the Patrick shit? I mean, in theory, these people could have been hearing about this entire world of people that think that Patrick Clancy did it. And then they're hearing enough about the shitty investigation. And then they're hearing from Red saying, well, you know, because the only thing he ever put out there was it that you're aware that there's no way that Lindsay could have been saying full sentences? Because Patrick came in and testified in front of that jury.
Yeah.
That she told me, I tried to kill myself, like that sentence. And then he says, well, where are the kids? And she says, in the basement. Those two things. And there's like, she couldn't have said those things. So, you know, you're sitting there wondering if the jury is like, what the fuck is going on here? In terms of what they've heard, even though they're not supposed to have, and they're required to just stay with the facts and the evidence that was presented to them in trial. They can't consider anything else, but they're humans. You know what I mean?
Well, and that's what I'm getting at is it just seems dangerous to even have that be, I guess it has to be, but to be a possibility, because that would be to me an emotional, if you could get 12 jurors to be like, I just don't want her to. This poor woman, I don't want her to suffer at all, so let's just vote not guilty. That could have happened.
Totally. I mean, when you're looking at the case from, you know, outside looking in, you know, and you hear about a mother killing her kids, you're like, wow, like monster. You know, I mean, that's all our natural instinct. And then when you dig deeper and you start kind of hearing the background, and, you know, everybody was like, it's a lot like the Andrea Yates case back in 2001, where she, you know, she killed her six kids down in Texas. And it was another nightmarish case. And she was also psychotic. And, you know, at that point, you're kind of like, all right, well, we need to look into this a little heavier, because, you know, there's two segments in society, probably three, actually. There's those that are of the mindset, you do this to your kids, I don't give a shit what's wrong with you. I don't care if you're crazy as a shithouse rat. You're going to prison. There is no excuse for it. I don't. You know, if you're that kind of monster, you need to be in prison for the rest of your life either way. So those folks exist. You see them all out there in socials. Then you've got the other people that I think would probably acknowledge that the treatment she received was lacking, that have that view that as mitigating to some extent, that might be willing to move off the murder one to either the murder two or even the manslaughter, which is a 5 to 20 year sentence. And it depends on Judge Sullivan, how he would sentence her. You know, he could go on the lower range with 5 per count for each kid, or he could go up to 20, you know, so you're talking either 15, if he's going to have them serve concurrently or consecutively, that depends. That's up to him. And with the manslaughter charge, because if it's murder one, it's life without possibility of parole. That's it. You're done.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I could see those folks where you've got the eye for an eyes. You did it. I don't care what the circumstances are you're going in. You've got the people that are like, all right, well, she did this to her kid. She's got to be punished, but I'm willing to give some leeway. I'm willing to move off the murder one and maybe slip to murder two and or even the manslaughter charge. And then you've got the people on the other side of it that are like, I believe her. You know, that the way that this has been operating and the patriarchy and the way that women have been viewed forever. And it's ironic that it's right near, you know, the Salem witch trials and all that shit. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, if you talk to women, and I took a very feminist stance on this case, you know, I believe that women have by and large been completely discounted. I think that men have no fucking business talking about anything having to do with postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis, or anything having to do with making a baby and how that affects their minds, because we have no fucking idea.
Right.
Period. End of conversation. We got no business talking about it. None of these experts that they put on had any fucking idea about it. You know, it's like you got a bunch of men testifying like exclusively about an absolutely woman issue. You know, there wasn't one woman testifying as an expert, and the defense had Margaret Spinelli, who was supposed to testify, and something happened with her where she couldn't, but she was going to be the one getting on there and educating everybody about the reality of the hormonal upheaval that's going on in a woman's body before, during, and after giving birth. You know, when they're getting pregnant, all the time, you know, the 9 months leading up to it, after they give birth, all of it. You know, and like us as men, I have no idea. I'm not going to sit here and pretend I couldn't even begin to tell you. And, you know, and it's insulting to women for men to be chirping about it. Oh, you know, like women, we need to repeal the 19th. They can't have guns. You know, all that shit, it makes me sick. The reality is that the system's broken, you know, and it's, I'm passionate about it, frankly, you know, and I believe her because what came in terms of testimony, and you know that the state looked long and hard for anybody on the planet that would be willing to come in and testify that Lindsay Clancy was anything other than a wonderful mother and a kind woman and who loved babies. Like, her life's work was delivering babies. This woman loved children. Her entire dream was to have a family. And it's inexplicable to think that there's any, like, no motive that they put forward made any sense. And I'm talking about the Commonwealth. The only thing that makes sense here is that she lost her shit. She was not in her right state of mind at that point. You know, and ultimately, when we kind of get down to the nuts and bolts of it, and you're thinking about the concept, and I still think, even though I sat through the entire trial, that it just didn't get fleshed out enough, because the million questions that we're having are like, can you, because the Commonwealth sitting there saying, you know, psychosis means you're seeing invisible unicorns in the corner and you can't make words and you can't plan anything. You can't operate knobs. You can't build a snowman with your kid that you're frothing at the mouth and your eyes are bugged out, like movie shit. And that's not what psychosis is. So they're putting out this, they're re-stigmatizing mental illness as it already exists in the world anyway, to the point where they're setting us back 1,000 years in terms of moving forward. Like, at what point in this country are we going to give a fuck about our most important organ, which is our brain?
Yeah.
Like, you break your arm, Bob, where are you going, man? You're going to the hospital, you're getting an x-ray, they're setting your shit and they're putting you in a cast. something's going on with your fucking brain. They have no idea. And they're throwing drugs at it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, she tried. And I'm going to tell you right now, and there's no bones about it, and I don't give a shit who comes at me. I 100% believe that Lindsey Clancy was in psychosis. I think that the treatment she got was completely insufficient. And the most powerful witness for me was the fact that, and I was sitting in the courtroom when Sue Clancy, which was her ex-mother-in-law, walked in during the defense's case. And Chief, I got goosebumps on my arm when she walked in, because I'm immediately thinking, like, my God, like the loss that this woman experienced. I mean, this, she's coming in to testify on behalf of the woman who is her ex-daughter-in-law, who took her 3 grandchildren away from her. And she's going to get up on the stand. And her testimony was everything. Like, she's like, she was begging for help. She was begging for help. She knew, everybody in that family knew what was going on with her, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of the bigger issue for me is if, like, and somebody asked this question, it was a good question. And somebody asked, like, well, Bob, do you think that Lindsey did anything wrong? I mean, aside from obviously ending her children's lives, like, that's obvious. But in terms of the treatment and whether or not she was following plans or taking the medication as directed, I think she was doing that. But the one thing that I thought that she did wrong, if I had to say it, was that she was underreporting what was going on with her. And that's not a Lindsey Clancy issue. That's a every woman that's going through this issue because of the way that society looks at it. You know, her concerns would be, well, I'm going to lose my kids. I'm going to lose my husband. I'm going to lose my license to be a nurse if I get sectioned, or if they say that I'm psychotic, I'm done. So she's got a whole lot of incentive to underreport and try to just get this thing managed by giving as little information as she can to her treaters. And if we can get rid of that portion of it, if we can create a safe space for women that are going through this shit. And oddly enough, I had an 8-hour mental health awareness live on our channel where I had real people coming in that have lived it, telling, dude, this was unbelievable. I had 8 medical providers, doctors, nurse practitioners that all deal with maternal health, like, and they were on the live with these people who were sharing, and it was all women. It was unbelievable. And there's a woman named Lisa Tremaine who has a center in New Jersey that's exactly what she does. She brings the women in if they're going through postpartum. She gives them a safe space. They bring their baby in, so they're not separating mother from child. Mm-hmm. And they bring them in, and they've got the doctors on staff there. The women come and stay. They treat them for as long as it takes, and the women can fully disclose without any fear of repercussion of what's going on with them. Like, nothing gets reported. Everything is so that they feel safe in terms of, and all of the women that come in there leave healthy, and all of the babies are safe. And if you can have centers like that in every, if that center exists in Massachusetts and Lindsey had access to it, the 3 babies are still alive. I guarantee it. This woman's incredible in the shit that she's doing. And I mean, that's where I'm at with it. Like, to me, it is massively about women's mental health. There's no other explanation, Bob. If you can give me any explanation how that woman, who we know everything about from the testimony from the Commonwealth's witnesses all the way through to her mother-in-law, to everybody that knew her, that she was begging for help. She was trying to get treatment. She was going through it. They were throwing drugs at her. She called the suicide hotline twice. She's telling people, I'm having these intrusive thoughts. And ultimately, you know, it gets to the point where she says she hears this voice. And that's the other part of it that people are having a hard time buying into. They're like, well, she just heard it once. Well, she complained of it once. Mm-hmm. And it happened after this. We don't know if it was actually happening for a day, 2 days, 3 days prior to.
Right.
If it was just something that was growing and she's terrified to talk about it. But what does come out from the most renowned filicide expert in the world, which is Resnick, you know, I mean, he testified for the defense. Unfortunately, it was via Zoom, you know, and he's old, but he was sick and he couldn't fly. But, you know, I mean, he's up there and he's talking about it, you know, and he gives his opinion, and he said she was psychotic. There's no doubt. And, like, my question to you, can you give me any other explanation other than she was psychotic as to why she would have done this?
No, I mean,
that you can think of?
No, I mean, I don't, obviously don't know the case that well, but from everything I've heard, yeah, that, I mean, and that's an interesting way, because I hadn't thought about it that way. Like, what other motive would there be if she's just, you know, a ratchet person that wants to get rid of her kids, but it doesn't sound like that's the case.
When it comes to plastic surgery, expertise matters, and CAP sets the standard. Our team includes 7 nationally ranked board-certified plastic surgeons. From tummy tucks, breast augmentation, and liposuction to facelifts and beyond, every surgical plan is tailored to your body, goals, and recovery timeline. CAPS is trusted for consistent, visible outcomes. Plus, when you book your surgical consultation, you'll receive a $100 CAPS MedSpa gift card. Expert care, exceptional results. Visit experiencecaps.com. CAPS, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
I actually have 2 questions for you. One, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on the legal front, putting aside all the different manslaughter and murder and everything, just so I understand, when the jurors went back to deliberate, let's just say, let's for this, just focusing on the murder one, whatever.
Yeah.
Their options were guilty, not guilty, or not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's guilty on murder one, which, just part and parcel of that statute, they could go down to murder too, or guilty of manslaughter, not guilty, and then guilty or not guilty by reason of lack of criminal responsibility.
Okay, so those are opposites. The other question I have is, one thing I've heard, and I don't know this to be true, it's just what I've heard it from my wife and daughter, when, you know, from what they followed on social media, was that, you know, you mentioned that she was like begging for help, and she was telling people that she was having these thoughts of hurting the kids. Like, that was that was documented.
Yeah.
Was that one of the people that she was saying that to was her husband, Patrick. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So she testified, and Lindsay's mom got on the stand and testified that a few days before this went down, that she had both of them together. And she said, she's like, I'm really nervous to say this to you, you know, but I've been having thoughts about harming the kids. So, like, that came into testimony, and that I can't remember if it was 3 days before the shit went down. So, yeah, she had put them on notice that she was having these intrusive thoughts.
So that's where my question comes in. The question that keeps asking me, and I think it's a good one, is, so I'm thinking about as a father and a husband.
Yeah.
If my wife comes and tells me, I'm having all these issues. I know that she's being treated for this postpartum depression, psychosis. She's on these medications. She's telling me she's having thoughts about harming the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not leaving her alone with the fucking kids.
Right.
And so, and that's another question that in my response to my wife, just from a personal standpoint, I'm curious from a legal standpoint, was they're like, well, shouldn't he be responsible? And I said, my feeling on it is, that should be two separate. Do I think he bears some responsibility? Absolutely. Should that affect her trial? No. But is there a world where there could be other charges where somehow he's held responsible in some way for this happening because he left a woman with his kids who told him that she was thinking about hurting his kids?
Yeah, I mean, look, in light of the Crumbly cases up in your neck of the woods, you know, with Ethan Crumbly, the school shooter, and they went after the parents.
Yeah.
And then again with Colin Gray, with his son, Colt Gray, you know, again, he's got the shrine in his room. He goes and buys his fucking kid a gun, knowing that his kid's got issues, and his kid goes and does what he does. Colin Gray got found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. So does there exist the possibility now with those types of cases coming in where you're being held responsible for basically ignoring things that are sitting right there in front of you and that you shouldn't have, and that you should have known better, and but for you leaving, or maybe you're the one who has to section her or try to get her in into a, you know, involuntarily committed somewhere. Maybe, you know, but like the question was then asked, you know, well, what did you say to Lindsay? And the question was, well, you've thought about it, but do you really think that you'd harm the kids? And she said, no, that's what their testimony was. Mm-hmm. You know, because like I'm the same way, Bob. I'm, you know, I've been married to Allie for 20 years, man. Like I've been with her for fucking 28 years. You know, I know this woman. Like if something's off with if I know she's going through it and I know how my wife is, and I'm going to fucking know whether she's telling me or not. You know what I mean? But right. I can't judge everybody the same way that I know my wife. You know what I mean?
Well,
everybody's
said,
not us, dude.
Yeah.
You know
what you just said is exactly. So this originally came up. It was when the trial first came out, when all the TikTok Patrick Diddick shit came out.
Yeah.
And Bella was still home from school then. And I like walked into this shitstorm of her and Becky talking about this thing, right? And they're like,
dude, that was every house in America that had women in it.
Yeah. And they asked me, they were like, you know, he did this. And then Becky asked me, she said, if I told you, she's, you know, and this, they were, the premise they were talking about then was whether he actually did it and that whole conspiracy thing, right? But she's like, if I told you that I was having these thoughts of harming our kids, would you leave me alone? And my response to her was, absolutely not. But, and I named a person, obviously not going to name him here, I was like, but that person would. This other husband that we know absolutely would.
Right.
She's like, what? I said, just because somebody's maybe an asshole or a shitty husband or doesn't, you know, someone else may have let, and that was kind of around the, does that mean he did it? And my answer was, no, I don't think that means he did it. But then it creates this broader question of like, should there be some kind of responsibility there? And to me, you know, me being me and you being you, like I'm looking at like, yeah, like as soon as her trial's done, you need to put his, at least for, like you said, involuntary manslaughter or something. There should be some responsibility there. He left his children with a woman who is saying she's having thoughts about hurting his children.
See, and here's where it gets complicated, because that day, and this is part of the Commonwealth's case, she was texting, sending a picture of her out building a snowman with the kids.
Yeah.
You know, brought one of the kids to the doctor, drove. And that, like, that's the kind of shit where the Commonwealth is just like leaping all over it. Like, she's not psychotic. She's doing normal shit.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, it wanes and waxes. It's like you're not a frothing lunatic every second of every day. Like, you can talk to anybody who's gone through psychosis. That's just not how the disease operates. It's just not. That's movie shit. Real life shit is not like that. So, you know, if you're Pat, And look, you and I are built different. You know, we're real in tune with our women. You know, like you and I are sensitive dudes, man. You know, like we just fucking get, you know, I mean, we're built different like that. And a lot of guys aren't like that. And he'd been going through it for 4 fucking months. And, you know, we're reading her journal entries. Like, I can feel the distance growing between myself and Pat, my husband, and I want to rebuild it. And I want to get closer to him again. So she's going to be underreporting shit to him in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So like whenever this conversation takes place, she's got the mask on, man. Like everybody, how many times, like every single one of us has awful fucking days. And when Bob Ruff has an awful fucking day and then he goes in and talks to his students, he's got the mask on. They're not knowing how shitty your day was before you got to school.
Right.
Because we all put our mask on. Nobody knows what's going on with us internally. A lot of us will mask it. You know, you fake it till you make it. You go in, you put on a face, and you power through your shit. And to a certain extent, she was doing that. And then to a certain extent, she's worried about losing her husband. So she's got that going on. So, I mean, I give him some grace. And with the length of time it was going on, like, I think he was there to support her. I mean, he was working from home, you know, and it's like he was fucking bitching at the doctors, and like, you're giving her the Seroquel, you're turning into a fucking zombie. Like, what are you people doing? You know, so he was in it. But, you know, like, that's that thing that I was talking about. Like, if I were to blame Lindsay for anything, it's the underreporting aspect of it.
Yeah.
But I blame the system because women don't feel that they have the autonomy to be able to be completely honest about what's going on with them because of fear of reprisal from everybody, from the world, from your spouse, from your fucking work, everybody, you know, because like people just want to diminish what is going on with women when they give birth, which is, I mean, think about that. Like you're making a baby, you're baking a human in you, you're sharing all your shit, and your hormones are like in complete upheaval.
Yeah.
Like, and we have no, like, we don't know shit about the human mind. Mm-hmm. Like in all these guys that are going in there. I mean, the DSM-5, Bob, doesn't have postpartum depression as a standalone disorder. Think about that. You know, it's like when I think about the fact that when the 19th Amendment was finally passed in this fucking country, that women in the 1900s weren't allowed to vote. You know, that woman, if you were married up until 1974, you couldn't get a credit card unless your husband co-signed it. That's how women have been treated in this country forever. And, you know, it's no wonder that women aren't going to feel like they can share fully. And you know what happens when that occurs is nightmares like this. I'm telling you, if they had a center like this Lisa Tremaine has in Jersey, and she could have gone in and she could have lived there with her baby for six, and they bring the family in, they incorporate everybody.
Yeah.
Eventually, and she's getting the treatment and she can fully disclose everything that's going on. She gets well and the kids are alive. Like if we have these centers everywhere around the country, this shit goes away. Because it's like, to me, it's a no-brainer, and I don't understand what the holdup is.
Well, if anything good is to come out of this horrific situation, I would hope that what I'm seeing is there's a lot of conversation around exactly what you're talking about right now, about treatment, about the stigma, about all these things. Hopefully, at least that happens. As far as, you know, to wrap this up, as far as the case is concerned, ultimately, it ended in a mistrial. From what I've heard, and everything I've heard said, this is according to Reddington, so I don't know if it's been shown to be accurate. Out of the 12 jurors, 11 of them were voting not guilty by lack of criminal responsibility, and there was one holdout who just would not come off it, wouldn't agree, so they ended up having to do a mistrial. Is that known to be accurate at this point?
That's known to be accurate. There was one male holdout that got let slip. Like the number came out from the foreperson, what the count was, that there was 11-1 NG for lack of criminal responsibility. And then it also got let slip by, I can't remember if it was the judge of the state or Reddington or all of them. They like kind of let it out that it was a guy. Mm-hmm. So, and there were only three men on the jury. So everybody's like trying to figure out like which dude was it? Like I have my thoughts on it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, I think I know which guy it was, but you know, obviously I have no idea. You know, what the bigger thing is the way that the note read is that the note reads in some form or fashion that he acknowledged that he had that there was doubt. However, he refused to apply the law. So that's where the big thing is. So Reddington, that was a real war, man.
Yeah,
because like, the judge comes out, Reddington that morning, because the note had come out late in the day before the date of the mistrial, where the official mistrial happened. And so the judge calls it. He has them back out. He gives them the Tui Rodriguez charge, or also known as like a dynamite charge, where it's like, I hear you, but you got to go back and you've really got to get back there and do the work. I know you could do it. No other jury is going to be as smart as you. No other jury is going to look at the facts any differently. You have to be the jury that does it. You know, it's like that real heavy duty pressure on a jury to compromise, which I kind of hate.
I do too. Yeah.
And then, so they go back and then the next day, and then after that comes out, Reddington in the meantime is like, I want you to voir dire this fucking individual. Sure, you need to ask this guy, you know, are you going to follow the law? If you think that there's doubt, I'm sorry, no matter what your personal feelings are about it, because this is clearly a guy who's in that camp. You killed your kids, you're going in. I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
It's clearly that guy. So, you know, in my estimation, when Red goes in and asks for the judge to do that, the judge is like, I'm not willing to do it. Like, I'm worried about the provenance of the deliberations. It's like, I don't even know how I'd get to that with them without involving myself in the deliberations. And I right. think that there's a way it can be done generically, you know, where you're just kind of saying, look, I'm not asking you what has been discussed back there. I'm not involving myself in your deliberations, but I'm instructing you that if you have found that there is doubt, that you have to apply the law. And I'm going to leave it at that. You have no other choice. You swore to do that when I impaneled this jury, that you would follow the law. And, you know, have that kind of conversation. The judge wasn't willing to do it. So ultimately, they end up going back. They're back there for like an hour, hour and a half. In the interim, they send the note back. This whole day was fucking chaos. So they send the note back. They're like, we're hopelessly deadlocked. This guy's not budging.
Yeah.
You know, and all the people out there, oh, the king, the holdout, the guy's a hero, all that shit. I'm like, what? The guy's refusing to apply the law. He's not a hero. He's a fucking, it's reverse jury nullification because, you know, he's not, he shouldn't have been a jury. He either lied on the front end or he changed his mind mid trial where he said, I can do it. And then when the facts of the case come out, he's like, I'm wrong. I can't do it. Like, she's got to go in. You know what I mean? Whatever the case may be, whether he lied on the front end or whether he changed his mind.
Because he, according to the note, acknowledged, I have reasonable doubt that she.
I don't know if he used the word reasonable. That's where the thing is. Okay. Like the way that the four person wrote it, and I don't know that we've seen the exact wording. I'm dying to see this note. But she said that he acknowledged that there's doubt. So that's, you know, because like, look, in Massachusetts, it's moral certainty. That's like you. It's a high bar. Like we don't have that kind of language in Illinois in terms of reasonable doubt. It's got to be moral certainty. So it's a high fucking bar. So I think that there's like wiggle room in terms of that guy. Like what? Well, you know, I mean, like an inkling of doubt. Like it's not enough to word for me. It's reasonable. That could be argued. You know what I mean? So we don't know exactly where it is. But then again, to me, if the judge has that very brief conversation without getting into the provenance of the deliberations, which is an issue. You know, you can't really have a judge getting in any way, shape, or form butting himself
web,
in.
Yeah.
It's a very, very tangled web, man. So, you know, but in the interim, Red files this petition up to the... So before the judge declared this a mistrial, like Reddington stands up and he says, I'm asking for a stay pursuant to 211.3. And I'm filing a motion to the Supreme Court to double check your shit here because you're refusing to do the voir dire. And I'm asking for a stay. Judge says, I'm giving you an hour. So, you know, in the meantime, he reaches out to an appellate attorney and appellate attorney's furiously getting this fucking thing done, this petition, gets it up to the Supreme Court in the same day. It's a single justice hears it. And the single justice hears it. And like we were able to watch it on live stream. The shit was happening in real time. I've never seen anything like it. This whole trial was unbelievable. It was like the entire criminal justice system on display. Like every weird part of it was like right there for all of us. And we're watching it in real time. So they make their arguments. And then she turns around real quickly and says, stay denied. So at that point, judge calls the jury back out, declares the mistrial.
So
and there you have it.
So, and I wonder, I'm already running long, but I wonder if the fact that juror knows, you know, her being institutionalized, that she's going to be institutionalized until she's no longer a threat to herself or others, that, well, this was postpartum psychosis. She's clearly beyond that now. And she's in a wheelchair. So there's probably a very, you have to be thinking, she's going to go to a mental institution for a year and then go on with her life.
If you're that guy, for sure.
Yeah, I wonder if that's run through their mind.
I mean, but like the other thing that came in is, I mean, she's still suicidal. Like, I mean, no prison on the planet is worse than the one that's in her mind.
Right.
She killed her kids. She knows she killed her kids. This woman is like has no desire to be on the planet Earth anymore. They've got her on 24/7 one-on-one.
Yeah.
Like she's never left alone at any point. Because she is an absolute threat to kill herself.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to be here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like there's no question about it. You know, and the question that a lot of people had is, you know, like, did the defense lean into that aspect of it enough? Like, cause you know, and I know that we're running long, but you and I have never finished an episode in an hour anyway. So I think we set a precedent for it. Yeah. So like, you know, but like the Commonwealth is really trying to wring the pathos out of the fact that the kids are dead, you know, which they do. Yeah. That's always the secret weapon of the Commonwealth. That's something that they rely on, like drawing that emotion out, like inflaming the jury, making them angry. You know, but Reddington, you know, there was criticism. Did he lean into how destroyed that Lindsay is about that she did this to her children specifically? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's a lot of talk that she's suicidal, but they didn't take the extra step and say, well, why? Why are you so destroyed? Are you destroyed because your life is ruined, or are you destroyed because you killed your own kids and you fully realize it now? And you're never going to have your life back. Everything that you had is gone. Everything. You know, that's the kind of thing where maybe you lean into that a little more to make it clear of where she's at, you know, because she didn't testify. You know, you're hearing a lot of people talk about her, and you're never hearing her talk, you know. So, yeah, man. And, you know, the last question is whether or not they're going to retry her.
That was the last question, yeah.
That's the million-dollar question. I mean,
they almost I would think, because the other option is she just walks free and she doesn't get institutionalized. She doesn't, and probably if what you're saying is right, she probably ends up taking her own life.
I mean, I could see a world, because I think when you're the prosecution in a case like this and you have three beautiful children that were murdered at the hands of the person who's absolutely supposed to protect them over anybody, except for, you know, I mean, mama bears are mama bears, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like you hear it and your initial gut instinct is like, fucking put her away forever. What a monster, who could do that to their own children. And then as you hear the facts of the case and the way that this thing built steam, it's like you were saying, I mean, coming into it, you're like, you know, whatever. Like Clancy, I don't even know what the fuck's going on with it.
Right.
You know, and this trial really, like, I knew it was going to be a thing. Like, that was why I had it out there. I knew, because when I got out there, the media throng was very small.
Mm-hmm.
As this thing started building, and the controversy was building, and the women of the world were coming forward feeling emboldened, like, fuck, this guy's like, Reddington's a hero. He's finally sticking up for women's mental health and women's rights, and like a 75-year-old fucking white man hero guy.
Yeah.
You know, the most unlikely hero. And so it grows into this thing where, like, I'm sure you saw the videos of like this throng of media, like just surrounding, enveloping him. You know, if you're the Commonwealth, could you clean up a bunch of shit in your case and maybe have a better shot where it's not 11-1? Probably. Are you ever getting a 12-0? Not a fucking chance. So you look at it and you see that your community, you know, you got to go out and talk to those people. You got to look at the fact that all of the family is supporting the woman who did it. That's a fucking problem. How many times have you seen that?
Yeah.
Like, honestly, where the victims' families are testifying on behalf of the woman who did it. That's got to have some weight. You know, like what is your job? If like, what does justice look like in this case, man?
I think that,
you know,
and I don't know if this is a practical view on it, maybe not a legal view on it. I think that if I was the state, what I'd be looking to do is let's do a plea bargain that puts her in an institution and move on.
Right.
Because you're right. You're probably right. If they put on their best case and they got 11-1 against, they're not going to get a conviction. And it seems like if that was their defense, they're willing to accept that. If that's a world that's possible, I think that's probably, again, layman's, for, you know, from a layman's perspective, like come up with a plea bargain where she pleads guilty and goes to an institution and not to a prison. And then I don't think they can just say, because there's three dead kids, I don't think they can turn and face their constituents and be like, we decided not to do anything about this. They got to do something.
Agreed. It would have to be a plea agreement, you know, where maybe they even get the defense to agree that she goes in for X amount of years. But like, I don't know how that operates. Like, if you've got doctors in there after year three and she's agreed to 5 years and they're like, but she's healthy. Yeah. How do we justify keeping her in here? You know, it violates the law. I don't know how that works. Another person, it was oddly somebody in my chat, they'd come up with an interesting concept wherein they agree to her pleading not guilty for lack of criminal responsibility, but they also get her to plead on a lesser included that they throw in there, like anything. Like that's short of the a homicide charge,
manslaughter, something
like like not even that, endangerment of children.
Yeah,
like you know what? Like you shouldn't have been underreporting. Like you put your kids in this danger because you were under, like whatever the case may be. And what they do is they say, okay, when she's healthy, when they deem her well, that she'll go in and serve 2 years, considering that she's mentally well. On this other charge that she's pleading guilty to, like an endangerment of whatever, you know, whatever kind of charge they can come up with, that's a lesser charge than a homicide charge. Yeah. Like, I don't even know if that's possible. I don't know if Reddington would agree to it or Lindsay would agree to it, but that's kind of a, like a decent workaround where you're getting like a little bit of both worlds. You know, you're getting her treated where she should be, but you're also, you know, getting her in to serve some amount of time in prison, which may satisfy. You know, I mean, the people that are like, she needs to go in and like they need to throw away the key or she needs to be buried under the prison. They're never going to be satisfied. You know, right. What I mean, like there's no satisfying those folks. But I don't find those folks to be rational people.
Yeah.
And I find that those people are deniers of mental health and mental illness. You know, I mean, like, you know, like so it's a slippery slope. Like you're creating a pathway for all these women to start killing their kids. And they're just going to say they were in psychosis. I'm like, get the fuck out of here, man. That's not how this shit works.
Right.
You know, it's just not how it works. So
to me, as I'm sitting here spitballing, I think like the perfect plea bargain is you agree to be institutionalized for 5 years and then be reevaluated. In 5 years is like you're something like 5 years, your minimum term. If after 2 years, the doctors say you're healed, then the remainder of that 5 years you serve in prison and then something like that. That's probably a crazy something that couldn't actually happen in the law.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. It's exactly what my, that thing that I was just talking about, like where you got the thing and then she gets well.
Yeah.
And then she goes in and serves this sentence. But yeah, I mean, some kind of hybrid thing like that, I'm sure that they could figure out a way to do it. Yeah. You know what I mean? And then everybody's satisfied. The fucking Commonwealth gets their pound. And
either, you know, everybody's satisfied or everybody's equally unsatisfied one way or another. Right. It's all.
Yeah, it's a wild case, but it's wildly important to me. I think that I hope the discussion doesn't stop in terms of the mental illness. I'm very thankful that conversation has taken place, even if it's heated. Mm-hmm. It's just important to have it, you know, because it's going to embolden people to come forward. And I'm telling you, man, that 8-hour thing that I did with these people willing to share, and I was nervous. You know, I had to have mental health providers on there because people's stories, Bob, about the shit that they've gone through with mental illness is fucking unbelievable. Like, but you have to hear it from real people in order to understand what it is. Because most of us that have been lucky enough to never have it in any way, shape, or form affect our lives, whether it's personally or somebody that we love, you can't understand it. Like people can't understand the concept that you can slip out of reality to the extent where you literally have no control over your mind. And you can't say, I'm going through some shit right now. Like I'm fucking thinking crazy. I gotta go. You know what I mean? It's like, you're gone. Like you can't, like it's not there. You're literally a puppet to whatever the disease is doing in your mind. And it's real. Like people just don't, like some people just do not think it's real. And like old heads, you know, like you get even older women that went through the postpartum depression back when men didn't give a shit. They're like, you know, what are you talking about? Rub some dirt. You know, they just struggled through it. You know, they're like, I went through it. You know, rub some dirt on it. You're going to be fine. You know what I mean? So it's like, and, you know, the medications, I don't like, there's just so many parts of this thing, which, you know, Andrea Yates, I don't know what they had back then. You know, because like there's the argument that the Zoloft, you know, when they missed the manic thing, like early on, and she ends up, they give her the Zoloft, that's what triggered everything, you know, because it's an SSRI, and you know, somebody who had a manic episode should never be given an SSRI, and that just spun her out, and then they just kept giving her shit, trying to like, and honestly, in good faith, I don't think that these doctors were just being like evil. I just think that they weren't doing the therapy part of it.
Right.
They were just saying like, all right, and you know, and she was probably a pain in the ass because she's a labor and delivery nurse. You know, she's doing her own research. She's trying to figure it out, you know, and she's looking for the magic pill that's going to make everything go away. And so she's willing to take the shit, you know, everything that they're trying. And she's like, she takes it for a few days or whatever. it's not working. It makes things work. You know, I don't know, man. It's like the whole thing was just a mess, man, you know. But ultimately, I think if she had the ability to be able to report openly about everything that was going on, we're not here.
Yeah. Well, it's a wild case, and I really appreciate you coming on. And I feel like now I can go into my house and have a conversation with my wife and actually understand what the hell is going on, because this has been super confusing. But I'll let you go there. Check out at the Defense Diaries page for, I assume that stream is up on your YouTube channel and all that.
All of it. And all of our coverage was awesome.
And if I know Bob, I haven't watched them, but the amount of live stream, you see 3 weeks times what, 20 hours per stream. There's probably three months worth of content to listen to.
Yeah, there's no shortage, Bob.
Yeah. So go check that out. Again, Bob, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Always, Bob. Love it, man.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.